Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Duane DeFreitas.
And I'm Chris Brenor, back from the past. I don't know where I'm back from, but I'm back.
Abyss of life.
It is so the glad to startup. Have you back, Chris. It's like a... hopefully we won't be without you for that long of a time again. It was only 2 weeks, I think, but it felt like forever.
Yeah, it did for me too. It was a long 2 weeks.
Anyway, on this week's show, we'll talk about Google's ambitious plan to put gigabit fiber in every home, beginning with Kansas City, and a look at the 2012 London Olympics, an Olympic so far fraught with technical challenges and social media disputes. But first, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And the gadget that I have been playing with, and this is going to be a partial kind of... I'm only going to talk about it a little bit because I haven't really gotten into it, but I finally cracked open my Raspberry Pi, which is the $35 Linux computer, and assembled it with a... I got a nice case from Adafruit Industries, which is Limor Fried's maker... startup, and it's this clear. I love this case, by the way. It's a clear polycarbonate case that assembles together very nicely and just surrounds the Raspberry Pi and sits in there. And the whole idea for getting the Raspberry Pi was I wanted to show my daughter from the beginning, from step one, about building her own computer, essentially, and operating it. And so, like, the hardest thing so far has been, and I had to cooking show it, as they say in the business, where you prepare something in advance so that when it's showtime, it's just there. You know, the cooking shows make their casseroles in advance, so they pull them out of the oven and they're already made. So I had to cooking show the flashing the SD card with the variation of Debian. It's called Raspbian Wheezy, and it's made specifically for the Raspberry Pi. So I had to flash
Raspbian Wheezy.
Yes,
that's hilarious.
Wow.
I'm not a huge Linux person, and I think this is one of those instances we were talking earlier on before we started the show. Chris, where we're glad that you're on now because this is kind of your forte talking about this kind of stuff. I'm not a huge Linux person. I'll be the first to admit it. I've run a few distros on machines in the past, but few and far between. But so it was a little weird once again to kind of flash this SD card with the Raspbian, and I started up and started getting it going. Just enough so that when I plug it in to the system, to the TV and the power and everything, that it works. So my daughter sees that it works. And so that's the stage we're in. It's an ongoing thing. I'll give you some more updates once I've actually sat down with my daughter and we've done it together. We've started, you know, looking at this this distro and figuring out what we can do with it. I think the ultimate thing that I'd like to do with it is to teach her some programming, some, you know, basic programming with it. So she's 7, so she's probably about the age where she can start to pick that kind of stuff up.
Yeah, I think that's about when I was actually probably a little bit older when I first started programming. So yeah, I would it's awesome to get started with, you know, pick some I don't know, like Algol. Did they have a version of what's that turtle program that everyone starts off with?
I think wasn't it just called Turtle? I remember that.
Yeah. I don't know. I never actually did it myself, ironically, but, you know, everyone else had done it, even like in the grades that I was in. Like, people had, you know, had experience with that. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember Turtle very, very much.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Debian is probably – I'm glad – is this something that sort of they provide, or did you have to sort of search online for how it works?
There's a great site. I think it's called raspberrypi.org, and it's kind of the central repository for the information about the computer. I think it's run by – maybe run by the people who put these boards together, these PCB boards together. Mm-hmm. And so they have like a beginner's guide.
Okay. I've really wanted to get one of those ever since I got one of them, you know, one of those sort of low cost machines, just because, I mean, I do have the expertise in Linux. And it just seems like having a computer that can basically, you know, it doesn't have to be super powerful, but they can do something, you know, for $35. I mean, $35 is, I mean, it's, if you think about it, it's less than we used to pay for applications. I mean, it actually probably is about less than a game, at least.
Yeah.
You know, maybe not an iPhone game, but, you know, a normal person game.
It was an easy payment to justify to my wife, that's for sure.
Yeah. So what are you doing for storage on it? Did you have to buy a separate flash drive?
The storage, it is all on the one flash drive. Like, the flash drive slot, the SD card slot is the one kind of all around storage. There's two USB ports, and you can you know, get USB hubs and plug in an outboard storage if you really want to. But for the purposes of just keeping it simple, we're just going to go with the SD card for now. You know, I might actually get. I was seriously considering, after seeing this project on RaspberryPi.org, seriously considering getting another one of these devices and using it as an XMBC, you know, client.
Is it powerful enough?
They say it is, and people have done. You know, there's demonstrations online of people using this as a media server.
Wow,
and it's got an HDMI
sort of
out.
That it couldn't handle that.
Well, I guess it could serve like it could run like the DLNA. You just can't plug it into a TV and expect it to actually render the video for you.
It's got HDMI out, and it does high def video.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't.
Does it have
it.
Like a specific board for that, or like a specific graphics processing unit? Or is it just that?
I think it transcodes video. It does it all, you know, internally, the video transcoding.
That's a hard sell for me. I guess an iPhone can do it, right? Like, that's what the Apple TV is.
Yep.
It's an iPhone chip. It's the A5X single core, so it's not even a dual core chip. Mm-hmm. I guess if that could pull off 1080p of sorts, then
but the iPhone chips are they're good chips.
But they're 32-bit, right? Like, they're not running 64-bit OSs. They're 32-bit OSs, and they're chips that are, you know, really low power, and they don't compare to the desktop versions of them. So if this is anything close to that, then I guess I could see how it works. It's counterintuitive when I first think about it.
Anyway, Dwayne, what have you been playing with recently?
Oh, man, I've just been playing. First thing, today I got the Amazon Prime Instant app.
Oh,
it is
wonderful.
I mean, like, it's actually like you can't search on it, so it's a little annoying.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like having a second Netflix sitting on my iPad, loving me. So it was pretty. It's pretty awesome. It's also, there's no Amazon app on the Apple TV, but this app does allow for AirPlay. So you can play on your Apple TV.
Oh, nice.
So it's really something. I'm really impressed. I thought this would never happen. I thought Amazon would say, hey, get a Kindle Fire, get the Kindle Fire 2, get whatever. Like, you're not going to, you know, I'm not going to, like, put my content on Apple's platform. But I think, you know, time told that, you know, this was the way to get that distribution. This was the way to get that thing. So, you know, I'm excited about it.
I would think
it would
be the opposite, not Amazon's. Amazon doesn't care as long as you buy their stuff. I figured it would be Apple that would care. You know,
well, that's probably why it's not on the. They haven't figured out an agreement for the Apple TV yet. I think that's probably why. I mean, Apple TV launched with Netflix because Netflix was, I think it still is. It's the undisputed king of home entertainment, like streaming services when it comes to video, right? Like, Apple actually lost out when it comes to home home video services. Netflix has recently taken them over. I think it was in early July or late June or something like that. So there's that. But this is Amazon being like, we need to get into this game, and iOS is where it's at. Look at all these iPads being sold. Boom. So it's really good. Hulu Plus just showed up on Apple TV. That's kind of exciting. Hulu Plus is very confusing, is the only problem I've had. Like, they, you know, this program you can watch now. This program you have to watch only on your computer. This program, we're going to only give it to you a month after it aired. And there's a lot of caveats. So this program is only available on normal Hulu, not Hulu Plus. And you're like, I paid for this. And they're like,
Wait, there's stuff that you only get if you're not on Hulu Plus?
Yeah, it's kind of weird. Like, this is how it was when Hulu Plus like first came out. Like, there were shows that were available on Hulu Plus. Like, you can get back episodes of them, but you can get back episodes of shows that were on regular Hulu, but you couldn't get those back episodes on Hulu Plus. You know,
well, what's to stop you from just logging out?
Well, the thing is, on the applications, like what you get on your Xbox or PS3 or I guess just PS3 and on your Apple TV, what you get is Hulu Plus. You have to log into a Hulu Plus account.
So essentially, they're saying this is available on the computer, but not on
your other devices. You know, because if you're gonna watch an NBC show on television, on your television, they just want you to watch it on your television because they make more money from the ads that way.
Oh, and we'll get to more of that too coming up.
Can I just say, like, I know that we're gonna get to more of this later. It's sort of the fundamental problem of
cutting the cord.
But like, I feel like fundamentally this is not as much a technical problem as like a misvaluation of advertising space.
It's a biz dev problem. That's all it is. Because it's more than just the advertising space. It's also like content providers and how much they want. Like, this is the problem with Netflix. This is probably the reason why Amazon Prime doesn't have search yet. Because if I could tell you to just search for a certain show, you look at it, you tell your friends to search for it and all that stuff, it becomes too efficient and suddenly all the licenses they have for the views on that show go away. That's kind of how it works. So, you know, there's cord cutting has come a long way from like the 2010 episodes of The Symbiotic where we kind of like tried to figure out what the world was going to be like. But still, it's still got some way to go. And finally, when it comes to all this stuff, I've been trying to get the Olympics on my iPad. And as a person who only had cable internet service and not cable TV service, it became a big problem. And I went and I had to go out and get basic cable TV.
Oh, wow.
And I got basic cable TV so I can get MSNBC and all these other things. And that gives me access to the NBC Olympics Live Extra app, which shows me the stuff on my iPad, which is really the only way I really enjoy the Olympics. I'm not sitting in front of my TV looking at it on TV, but my girlfriend does. And the sad part about that is when she goes to NBC to look at the Olympics, it actually comes through an SD television. Whereas when we pop out the cable from the little cable box and pop in the antenna, it comes in HD. But to get HD in the cable box costs more money, even though it's free from the antenna. So the whole like content distribution situation sucks, and it took how many ever days for us to get the live extra on the, you know, to all these, the iPad app and all the streaming to work, because they were like, oh, you don't have authorization, but I do. But do you really? Maybe you need to get the upgraded version of the cable package and all this other crap like that, when in fact, you know, it's just, there's a lot of hoops. They're really focused on all these hoops. So
yeah, I'm essentially boycotting the Olympics for this year basically because of this. Like, I have you know, an antenna, and I get over the air stuff, and I'm
there's
just
a lot you
not,
don't get with just the antenna is a sad part.
I don't even care. Like, they're not going to get any of my advertising dollars because I'm just pissed at them for their whole just
silliness. This is a man of conviction, man. Like, remember, this is the same guy who like got off of Facebook because he's like, they need to fix these privacy issues before I can get back on here and all that stuff. So I hear you, Chris. I hear you.
Yeah. Chris, are you playing with anything this week?
Yeah, I actually just discovered yesterday an awesome service called Buffer. So I don't know. I'm a sort of person. I love sharing articles on Twitter. I sort of discovered the value of Twitter when I realized that I could use it to share the articles that I sort of find. But I tend to find articles and do a lot of my discovery at weird times of the week, like Saturday morning or like late on a Friday night or, you know, 7 a.m. on a Tuesday.
Saturday which morning is, not, is the best time.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, Saturday morning has become one of my favorite times to just sort of like collect all the stuff throughout the week that I've found and like, you know, parse through it and share it. But most people aren't tweeting or reading tweets at 7 a.m. So the question is, well, how do you, you know, make sure that your tweets are time delayed so that you can, you know, send them out over time? And I've been using a service called Timely, which was free, but had very limited options. So I discovered this service called Buffer, which has sort of a freemium model, and it allows you to honestly, the coolest thing that they've done with it is it. So it's a buffer for basically you schedule your tweets. You say, you know, four or five times a day, I want to send out my tweets. And you can hook it up with LinkedIn and Facebook and Twitter, and it'll give you some analytics on all of them. But I think the coolest thing that they've done is they've made it extremely easy to add stuff to your Twitter stream. So if you add the Chrome extension, it adds a link on Reddit. So instead of just, you know, vote up, vote down, comment, flag, share, there's an additional add to buffer link on every single Reddit thread. Hacker News, same thing. Slashdot, same thing. And they have an iPhone app. So it's extremely easy, no matter what platform, no matter where you are, to just simply add it to your buffer queue, which really saves me an awful lot of times in terms of like finding the article, emailing it to myself, going through it on Saturday morning, adding it to my timely queue. I don't know. I'm pretty excited about it. Seems like
I wish they had this for email.
Well, you can email to it. Oh, you mean like email out stuff to people?
Yeah, like just like the idea of emailing on a timer would be helpful.
Yeah, I'm sure there is. I don't know. I
like it's not.
I'll skip my email rant for now.
Should we get into some headlines? iMore has learned that Apple is planning to debut the new iPhone at a special event on Wednesday, September 12th, with the release date to follow 9 days later on Friday, September 21st. The information comes from sources who have mystically proven accurate in the past. The iPad mini will be announced at the same September 12th event as will the new iPod Nano. We haven't heard a release date for the iPad mini yet, but it could be the same as the iPhone 5. It seems likely the new...
Whoa. Let's back it up. I still think it's a mistake to call the device the iPhone 5.
The new iPhone. You know what? That'll probably be the name that they use, too. The new iPhone, keeping in line with this, the new sort of designation that they used for the new iPad.
I don't think there's any clear way to look at past success and determine future... past like actions and determine future actions from Apple, but I would say that the thing about mobile is that it moves very, very fast. And the thing about technology is that when you throw a lot of numbers on stuff, people get tired of it quickly. So
yeah,
I could see that. And like I said, when the iPad came out, I mean, Devinger seemed upset about the fact that they called it the iPad and not the iPad HD or whatever. But the fact is, we have an iMac, we have a Mac Mini, we have a MacBook Pro. We have a MacBook Air.
They've never changed the numbers on those. It's just people refer to them as, you know, MacBook Pro 2011, MacBook Pro 2010.
Exactly. So that's like a big leading indicator. And then there's the fact that, you know, just the number 5 in many ways doesn't make sense because it's not the 5th iPhone. And it's a little weird to call the 6th iPhone the 5th iPhone when they were pretty adamant that the 4th iPhone was the 4th iPhone. You know what I mean?
Sure. Sure.
So I just want to make sure that we're not going to make any like allusions as to understanding how Apple nomenclature really works. We've got some data to look at, and we've got some speculation out there, but we're not going to make the iPad HD mistake that was made before.
Did you see some of the photos of the assembled device based on repair sources?
Yeah, I've seen some of the photos. I think it's an attractive device. I don't particularly like the current design of the iPhone, even though I have one and I enjoy using it. So I'm looking forward to something that is a bit sleeker, is a bit thinner. I think the big takeaway I've got is this new technology that's allowing the device to be thinner because they have like less glass because they're able to get the stuff right on there. I think that's going to be a big deal when it comes to the next iPad because, you know, as we know, the current iPad is relatively thick. You know, it's thicker than the second iPad. And if they want to bring that size down.
But still thinner than the first iPad.
Yeah, it's thinner than the first iPad. It's just barely thinner than the first iPad. But they want to bring that iPad 2013 down in size. This is the way they're going to do it, and I think it becomes really impressive on a large screen device like the iPad. And you know, the second generation of this presumed smaller iPad will probably also make use of that technology in order to get more battery life out of it. So
that's where my excitement is. Plus the changed dock as well, with having less space taken by the 32-pin dock. With this new dock, they can squeeze in more components.
Yeah, from 30-pin connector to 19-pin connector, and I'm sure this is going to be able to take advantage of something akin to Thunderbolt speed. It's not really going to be based on the USB 2.0 spec or the FireWire 800 spec or whatever. So we'll see something new. Although Apple did just embrace USB 3 after years of everybody else having it, so that seems interesting as well. So we'll see. We'll see what they're up to.
I'm looking forward to it. And in fact, I'm really looking forward to it because I recently cracked the glass on my current iPhone.
I've had a sort of bet with my friends. We sort of like try to figure every time we get a group of geeks together, like how many geeks do you have to have before you have a 100% chance of having at least one of them having a cracked iPhone?
None. Like, you can have 50 because a real geek understands that the thing is made out of glass, and unless they are the faithful, and when I say the faithful, I mean capital T, capital F, who like are shoe cases and other protective gear for their iOS devices because they're just so important that they look exactly the way that Steve Jobs
had a case.
And Johnny I designed them. I feel like I hang out with a bunch of people who are iOS users, and you often don't see, you see that only from a lot of the people who are like focused on, oh, it's got to be pure.
No, I had a case, but ironically enough, not ironically, I think it was fate basically teaching me a lesson, is the case had dropped a few times and had cracked in one tiny corner, and the next time it dropped, it was that corner where the glass cracked, so... That's a lesson learned. If your case cracks, get a new one immediately because it served its purpose and it's time for a new one.
Exactly. Are you running an iPhone 4 or 4S?
Just the 4.
Gotcha. Okay. So you're kind of like ready for the new one anyway.
Yep. Yeah.
I think it's kind of interesting also how we had to wait, 15 or 16 months between the iPhone 4 and the iPhone 4S? And it's just a mere 11 months between the iPhone 4S and whatever this iPhone will be? If these rumors are true about the timing.
The 4S was always considered a stopgap in between the 4 and the new iPhone, whatever they're going to call it anyway.
Was the 3GS? I mean, the 3GS was out for that year as well, right? The first three iPhone devices came out in June of 2007, 2008, and 2009, respectively. The first four, 2007, 8, 9, and 2010. The iPhone 4S was the first one that was off schedule. So call it a stopgap, but...
it fixed a lot of the antenna issues, right? That was the primary thing.
Well, no, the Verizon iPhone 4 in February fixed a lot of the antenna issues because they moved the little lines so you couldn't bridge it with your hands. And they just kept that for the iPhone 4S. And they added the whole thing with it's going to switch back and forth. But I don't know how necessary that was after the Verizon iPhone because there was no antenna gate surrounding the Verizon iPhone. There was no like free cases or anything like that. It's just like we move the lines, you can't bridge it easily, and go, it works. That kind of thing. So I feel like the 4S, I think a lot of geeks like to call it a stopgap, but again, like when you follow the data, it's not really present to show that that's what it was.
Now moving on here, Duane, you pasted a link in our rundown about Verizon not being able to charge extra for tethering.
Yeah, I mean, this is really interesting, guys. Basically, the FCC comes out and says, okay, Verizon, you're charging extra for tethering on these, these plans you have, and it's not going to work because the spectrum that you're using now is new spectrum, and new spectrum has new rules. And those new rules say that usage is just usage. So Verizon balks, and they're like, okay. And they basically have to cut that out. And this is – a lot of people think this is the reason for some of the share plans that we've seen that don't care about your tethering, but that really just kind of focus on how much you know, bandwidth you get across a month, across a number of devices. So there is that. It's a little annoying because the rules are surrounding new spectrum that Verizon recently got their hands on. So you're not going to see this being able to be applied to AT&T, who's got that whole thing where you've got to pay extra for like, you know, tethering on your iPhone, and the iPad, the third iPad, doesn't allow you to tether, despite the fact that iOS had it built in on the AT&T stuff. So we'll see how that pans out. But I mean, this is definitely, I mean, the rules are different, but there's more and more fuel for the fire that shows that, like, you know, your bandwidth should just be your bandwidth. You bought it, you know.
Yeah. So is this a fallout of? I remember that when this spectrum was auctioned off, there was like a certain number they had to hit in terms of valuation, at which point some of these rules would kick into effect. And I remember that Google in particular was rumored to be like knocking up the price basically just so that the spectrum would hit those rules. Is this a consequence of that?
I don't have confirmation this is a consequence of that, but we did speak about that. And Google ended up making a deal with Verizon that said, okay, you can have it. I won't bid on it anymore. And Verizon said, okay, you can put anything you want. People should be – it's open. People will be able to put anything they want. We won't limit it to phones, that kind of thing. So, I mean, it's an interesting case. It's an edge case. But the idea that the FCC came out and said that you got to pay us $1.25 million, Verizon, and that, you know, this is not okay. That's a good thing. I think that it's you know, carriers using other blocks of spectrum, you know, the C block spectrum can't single out the type of work that's being done. But again, remember, net neutrality came through, and net neutrality said that for the normal spectrum, there is no net neutrality when it comes to wireless. When it comes to wired cable internet and all those things, net neutrality is there. You can't charge whatever, but they can throttle all they want when it comes to the other stuff. So that's why we have these funny rules on wireless.
All right, let's move on here. Microsoft took the wraps off a preview version of their new client called Outlook.com. They're billing Outlook.com as a new free mail service that pulls features from Hotmail and Exchange. It's designed for personal consumer use. Microsoft continues to position Outlook as its business email client. Outlook.com is integrated with Windows and Office, and it can pull in Twitter, Facebook, Gmail, and LinkedIn contacts. The new mail client has the Metro look and feel, and it's providing users with more granular control over what ads they see and where they see them. And Microsoft is providing Outlook.com users with 7 gig of free cloud storage through SkyDrive. I checked this out, and it's essentially Microsoft's answer to Gmail. And it looks pretty good. Or Gmail, and not only Gmail, but Google Documents as well, in a rudimentary sort of way. They have documents that you can generate out of Outlook.com.
Yeah, that's really interesting, especially because if you think about it, Gmail infringed on Microsoft's space first. And when I say that, I mean they came out with their sort of, hey, it's Google, and, you know, we're going to create Google Apps out of our, you know, Google Apps, which includes Google Calendar, Google Mail for Business, you know, the apps that you typically use, like Google Docs and Excel and things like that, or Spreadsheet or whatever. And they kind of went into Microsoft's world first. And this is Microsoft's sort of a, hey, we're here too. And the fact is, you know, we get it. We can totally give the user that a similar experience, but we could probably do it with products that they're more familiar with. And if you guys have ever been on like an Exchange server and logged into Outlook, your Exchange server from Internet Explorer, you actually get the multi-windowed Outlook look and feel. Same thing with Office 365.
Mm-hmm.
You get the multi-windowed Outlook look and feel in a web world, which is very interesting to say the least.
So. That was the last thing I used Internet Explorer for. Well, aside from testing to see whether or not my website was broken in Explorer, which it usually is. But yeah, no, it was one of their sort of trying to tie everything together. You know, it's amazing how long it took them to respond. Yeah. I mean, back when I was in college, and, you know, before 2005 or 6 or so, I mean, Outlook was literally the email program. Yeah. Like, Outlook and email were almost synonymous, to the point where
It was Outlook Express or normal Outlook. And if you had normal Outlook, you were Mr. Fancy. But Outlook Express was doing it fine as well. And they got rid of Outlook Express is the weird thing. They actually got rid of that program out of Windows. So, you know, it was only Outlook. And that program was actually much easier to deal with when it came to, like, migrating email messages and things like that. Because Outlook, who knows what the hell's going on with that PST and OST file. Like, what the hell? What are you doing?
I'll tell you what's going on. It's breaking. Those things have a size after which they basically start to degrade the database.
The 2 tera, if you're on a 32-bit system, the 2 gigabytes, and it's over. It's just, ugh.
Yeah, it's not I've dealt with quite a number of people who basically get to the point where their Outlook files are so large it just starts to corrupt. But anyway, I'm honestly really glad to see Microsoft starting to give Google a little bit of a run for its money. Because honestly, I feel like Gmail, I don't know, the last interesting thing that Gmail did was the 3-paned, you know, important, starred, and regular. And that was like, what, 2 or 3 years ago? And other than that, Gmail's basically been Gmail. It's the same Gmail.
And they got rid of the labs.
2006.
And they got rid of the labs, which is where the growth was. Right.
Right.
Yeah, they got rid of all the – I mean, Gmail has basically been stagnant for forever. I mean, this is why I feel like you can't ever have a benevolent technological dictator in tech, whether it's Apple or Google or any of these other – like, I mean, Apple and Google are genuinely creative, genuinely progressive companies. But like any other company – they're going to focus their creativity and effort on the places where there's competition. So if there's not competition in the email space, Google's not going to devote any engineering resources to it. And if Apple doesn't have any competition in the mobile space, they're not going to devote as much, consumer benefit add-ons to it. You know, it's a good thing to have competition, and this I'm extremely happy to see somebody else coming into the email space, because it's arguably one of the most important tools that everyone from, you know, grandma all the way down to, you know, a high schooler uses on a daily basis, and yet it has been basically stagnant for several years now.
Wow. So, yeah, that's a big thing. And then you also have to think about the fact that, on the other hand, with the benevolent email dictator, the last good client I saw come out in the email space was Sparrow, and then Google bought it.
Right.
And they had these great blog entries like, "What to do now that Google's bought Sparrow? How to prepare your Sparrow installation for it? Open up your applications folder. Open up your trash folder. Drag the Sparrow application from your applications folder into your trash folder." Empty trash. Because Google basically stopped all development on Sparrow.
Unfortunately.
The minute they bought it. Because they bought it for the talent, it seems. And Google, obviously, is not really big into the whole native program. You know, native app. So it's sad to see that.
As you can tell by their Gmail app, which sucks.
The web view, yeah. Anytime you see a web
view. No, even the native iOS Gmail app is...
It's a web view. You get in there, and it is showing you the web version of it through, like, a little shell of Objective-C.
Yeah. It tries to log me out every single time that it doesn't get connectivity. It's like, oh, you don't have any connectivity. Log you out. It bugs me to no end.
Yeah. If you want to get in touch with me, tweet at me. Send me an SMS. Because email, it's just too painful now.
Yeah.
Let's move on here. So the team at BetaWorks that bought Dig and pledged to roll out a rethought version of Dig by August 1st has done so. I don't know if you guys had a chance to take a look at this new version of Dig. It's a news magazine style. There are some aspects of this new version of Dig that have disappointed some previous Dig users. First of all, right off the bat, no commenting, at least for now. You have to log in via Facebook Connect. And
what?
Yeah. So you don't... So former Dig users can't currently access their old
legacy stuff.
Yeah, their legacy accounts. You log in via Facebook Connect, and that's how you access the stories, or able to dig up the stories.
I honestly couldn't even figure out how to vote up the stories. I was like, well, this is dig. I'm assuming I'm going to be able to dig something.
Yeah, yeah. There's a tiny little dig thumb at the lower, like the lower last line of every one of these stories. It's visual. I actually kind of like the visual take on it. And I understand like what they're going for in the long run. And I also understand that it might take a while to get there because they really kind of just rush this implementation out. Have you guys checked out this new dig? And if so, what did you guys think of this?
I avoided it.
So I played around with it a little bit. To see exactly what they had thrown out. And obviously I missed the dig button. You know, I want to defend BetaWorks a little bit here. I understand the difficulty of what they're going through. Like, they're essentially taking a product which was wildly popular and yet not terribly successful from a monetization point of view,
right,
and trying to figure out what to do with it. And the business problem here is you have something of value. I mean, so I don't know if you guys have read Peter Thiel's the Blake Masters note from Peter Thiel's startup course that he gave at Stanford this past spring.
Mm-hmm.
But so if you do a Google search for Blake Masters, this guy, I don't even know if that's his name or if that's just the name of his blog. But anyway, he transcribed the notes that Peter Thiel, who's one of the founders of PayPal, Peter Thiel gave a course at Stanford about entrepreneurship, and it's a spectacular read. I think even if you're not into startups, it's useful as a geek to understand the business constraints that affect technology. And one of the important things he talked about is that when you're a business, you have sort of two things you're attempting to do. You're attempting to create something of value, and you're attempting to extract value out of that. And Dig is in this position where it was able to create something of value. I mean, millions of people loved it, but it had difficulty trying to figure out how to extract value out of that it could use in a way that didn't essentially offset the value that the people were getting out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I don't know. They're in a difficult point where they're trying to decide, okay, is the value of Dig the actual news articles? Is the value of Dig the community? Is the value of Dig the commenting system? I mean, Reddit has very much sort of defined itself in terms of its community, so much right. So that the primary value of Reddit these days is not as much the links or the traffic that it drives,
right,
but the actual comment threads and stuff that gets posted to Reddit. I mean, several of the most popular threads on Reddit are purely like self-referential threads. Like, people just simply talk on Reddit as though it's a forum. It looks like BetaWorks is attempting to do is basically differentiate itself from Reddit and basically saying, okay, Reddit won the comment wars. We're going to try to win the traffic wars, essentially. Although I'm not entirely sure what they're thinking because of the whole voting thing being so downgraded. But anyway, I don't know. That's just sort of my thoughts on like the fact that, you know, they're never going to be able to please everyone, but they sort of have to not please everyone because ultimately what they have to do is turn this into a business that can actually at the very least sustain itself and hopefully return a profit some sort.
They said in one of their earliest blog posts regarding this, the BetaWorks team, they said that they did a frequently asked questions. And one of the questions was, how will Dig make money? And I'm going to quote here what their response was. We won't, not yet. We have little time and fewer resources to focus on anything but the user, who is our first, second, and third priority.
They could have handled that better.
Well, I mean, to be fair, the new Dig doesn't have quite the, at least it doesn't appear to be as obviously or directly, you know, focused on the stuff that their partners are. I mean, that was the thing that really pissed people off about Dig V4 was that it
right.
seems like it went from a user generated site to an advertiser generated site.
Yeah. What I'm saying is that basically, if they're going to cut off one of the core features of Dig, which is the voting, and then they're going to say, well, our job is to satisfy the user, that's a fail. You know, like that's a choice
defining what the user is. I mean, to be honest, like, I used Dig for a long time, and honestly, I never voted and I never submitted. I used Dig because I thought it was.
But that's a it's a core it's a piece of, it's like a core piece of functionality for Dig to dig something. It's a part of their name. So I think it's a little strange for them to be like, we're focusing on the user, but we don't have this functionality. Now,
they did launch it. It's just hard to find.
It's difficult to find. What I'm saying, it's like you gotta dig around. Maybe they want you to dig for the dig button. But the idea is that I feel like they – I want to cut them a little slack.
Yeah.
Despite what I just said, because, you know, it's rolled out. Hopefully it'll have several versions over a short period of time. They get it to where they need to get it. So I feel like – upon launch, this is going to be a bunch of disappointment. Also, Dig, its problem is that its legacy is huge, and people are just, you know, they're used to the old paradigm of Dig, and everything's going to be a disappointment at first. Everything.
Yeah. There's just That's honestly one of the biggest problems. It's like the big catch-22 of buying a big name that sort of has faltered a little bit. I mean, this is
keeping the name.
Honestly the problems that Google has every time it tries to launch something. I mean, if you want to be an upstart social network to take on Facebook, you know, you start off and you have, like, I don't know, a few hundred people who sign up for your site, and, you know, you build your site around your early users. I mean, that's how the whole startup world works. You find your early customers and you define your market around them. The problem with buying something like Dig is, you know, you have an early customer base of, you know, millions of people who look at your site. Mm-hmm. And that's an advantage, but at the same time, like, you're instantly judged by a huge swath of your market,
right,
with version 1.0. And that just makes it really hard to pivot or do any of the things that, you know, startups normally have as their strength. And the whole strength of a startup is they don't have to worry about a giant market. They just have to worry about pleasing their few customers and expanding them.
Yeah, I have to say that I'm going to cut them a little slack too. And I don't think that this is two things about this. First of all, I would not consider this necessarily Dig in the respect that the old Dig was. This is a new news aggregation service that happens to have the name of Dig. And I don't know that they'll ever match the same level of success that they did before, like Dig version 3. I think that was lightning in a bottle. It would be impossible to try and chase that. But I do admire what they're trying to do, and I hope that they keep doing it. And they have a huge advantage with having that legacy name attached to their service. So, you know, more power to them, I feel. And
yeah. Honestly, lightning in a bottle is a good way of describing it. I mean, it was a confluence of factors that were affecting the entire market, which honestly may never be reproducible. Like, the market has realized that social is a fundamental feature of the web, and now social is almost built into the fabric of the web. I mean, every single blog and website out there has a Facebook share button and a Twitter share button, and that's almost a commodity now. And maybe there just isn't as much value to having that sort of, you know, social layer that sort of can be tacked on to the news sources.
Right, and to Dig the new Dig's credit, I think that this approach is closer to what we're used to seeing in current, you know, social aggregators like Pinterest, for example, as opposed to the streaming thread like Reddit or the old Dig, which I feel like that's like a fading model. That you know, Reddit is hanging on to that on the sheer basis of the strength of their community, but I think if they didn't have that would be an outdated that would be an outdated model.
Yeah. Well, even Reddit. I mean, Reddit has deep monetization issues. Like, they're alive, as far as I can tell from a business perspective, mostly because of Reddit Gold, which is their premium service. I mean, they really are not an ad powerhouse. They're a community powerhouse, but they're not really a monetary powerhouse. And I mean, as much as it's, you know, we want to be about the community and all that stuff, I mean, ultimately, servers and programmers cost money, and you got to pay for them. I'm excited to see them honestly take some risks because... So Andreessen, or Mark Andreessen, gave a talk recently that I went to, and he was talking about how, like, one big problem you have when you have a change in leadership at a company is that, you know, they have a tendency to treat the things that the original founder did as sort of like sacred. Like, oh, well, the original founder did this decision, therefore we must respect it. And honestly, speaking as a, you know, semi-founder, like, sometimes you just make an arbitrary decision and it's not sacred. You just were like, well, I've got to pick A or B, so I'm going to go with B. And it's important to be like, okay, you know, we BetaWorks now own Digg. We literally are Digg. I mean, you know, Kevin Rose had his time in the seat and he built this up, and now it's our time to do it. We can't, you know, we need to respect the user and respect the things that he did, but at the same time, we also need to do our own thing with it and be its own identity and not just be a sellout to the advertiser. But at the same time, you can also be a sellout to the user and sort of like, I hate to say that, I mean, because the user comes first, but I mean, the user is best served when there's actually a service to exist. And in order for the service to actually exist, it has to make enough to support the service.
I have heard that argument before. I've heard that that stance before.
If you make it for the user, the advertiser will come. I know this because I'm an advertiser. So,
there you go.
I mean, that's definitive. If you make it for the user, the advertiser will come. So they need to think about that before they start justifying why they went this way or that way.
All right, let's take a little break here. Before we get and jump into our hot topic, let's talk a little bit about our sponsor. Our sponsor is Audible.com, and for the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And this week, the book I would like to talk about this week is called Tubes, A Journey to the Center of the Internet by Andrew Bloom. And in Tubes, Andrew Bloom goes inside the internet's physical infrastructure and flips on the lights, revealing an utterly fresh look at the online world we think we know, from the room in Los Angeles where the internet first flickered to life, to the caverns beneath Manhattan where new fiber optic cable is buried, from the coast of Portugal where a 10,000-mile undersea cable just two thumbs wide connects Europe and Africa, to the wilds of the Pacific Northwest where Google, Microsoft, and Facebook have built monumental data centers. Bloom chronicles the dramatic story of the internet's development, explains how it all works, and takes the first ever in-depth look inside its hidden monuments. I thought this book was kind of cool, although I haven't read it yet. I thought the idea behind this is really cool because it's actually the physical infrastructure of the internet, which nobody really talks about or focuses on. We all take it for granted what we see when we turn on our computers, and we take for granted that there are actual places that this happens.
Yeah, I mean, D.C., Oregon, Seattle, the West Coast. These are like the big hubs. One of those places goes down.
Yeah.
Shit goes down. Exactly. And I mean, I think about this often because when I was more on the logistics side of my firm, you know, you think about like what happens when like a Rackspace has an outage or, you know, takes down AT&T and what happened. There was a storm, and that storm, like, you know, there was an act of God here or there or whatever. And, you know, it's a pretty fragile system when you get right down to it. It's just robust in terms of its like its brute force strength. So, you know, this is a great topic for anyone who's interested in how –
the world works. I'm not just talking about the internet, but this is how the world works, right? This is how we communicate. And as social beings, it's good. It's just like how you should know how your car works when you put your foot on the gas. You should know how the internet works. And I feel like this is something that everyone should listen to.
I completely agree.
I thoroughly agree too.
That's a great point. You should know how this stuff works. In any case, Andrew Bloom's Tubes, A Journey to the Center of the Internet can be yours, as well as a 30-day free trial to give you a chance to check out their Audible service. If you don't like their service, you get to keep this book or any others that you choose instead of this book. Audible's got over 100,000 titles, so there's plenty to choose from there. And all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for your free audiobook, plus the 30-day trial to check out their service. We're going to take a little break here, but when we come back, we're going to talk about Google Fiber and Google's ambitious plan to connect everybody up with gigabit Ethernet and how this might have some of the major carriers and cable companies scared. So let's take a listen to this, and we'll come on back after this music. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down Live on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Christopher Bernor, and let's talk about Google Fiber. Now, Google Fiber has finally arrived in Kansas City, offering crazy fast gigabit broadband speeds and a new television service on both sides of the Kansas-Missouri state line. Google is touting 1,000 megabits per second download and upload speeds.
Stop for a second.
Yeah.
I need you to repeat that. Google is touting what?
1,000 megabit per second or 1 gigabit.
And I want you to now tell me what connection you have in your house.
I have I have no idea what connection I have in my house.
Chris knows what he has in his house. What do you have in your house, Chris?
Crappy. Like 33 megabit, I think.
I'm running 25, and I'm pretty happy. So imagine multiplying what I have by 4, and then multiplying that again by 10, which is essentially multiplying it by infinity when it comes to bandwidth. That's what Google is offering in Kansas City.
I just
want to make it clear the magnitude of what Google's offering in this space.
Yes, it's stunning. I saw their they had a conference in Kansas City where they were launching this on the day that they were launching it with the CFO of Google, and he explained essentially the rundown of the technical aspects of the service, and my jaw just kind of dropped. Let me continue here. Google says there'll be no monthly bandwidth caps and no overages, and it comes with a terabyte of cloud storage through Google Drive. But that's not all. They're also going to be bundling what they call Google Fiber TV, which is essentially a TV service that comes with a Bluetooth remote and search interface. Looks a little bit like Google TV, but cleaned up and much simpler. Can record up to 500 hours of HD shows on its 2 terabyte drive. And they're throwing in a Google Nexus 7 tablet as the remote for Google TV. And it'll be included at no extra charge with the TV package. Yes.
That's the future of remotes. That is, I mean, whether it's Google or iPhone.
I hope it's not, though, because I have an iPhone 3GS that I use as a remote from time to time. Yeah. And I got to say, tactile is everything when dealing with your electronics at home. Like, not really? Having to... I mean, the only remote I've ever tried that was on glass that was good was the remote for Plex. The Plex, the XPMC pull-off that is really quite fantastic because it has gesture-based remote controls. So you don't have to look at the phone when you use it. You just, like, you swipe to the left if you want to, like, go back. You swipe to the right if you want to go forward. You know, you double tap to play, you know, things like that. But, I mean, running your battery, your lithium battery, all the time just to control your TV is weird.
You don't run it all the time. It's not the running the lithium. It's, I mean, it's yes, gotta reconnect it's not tactile, to but, like, just look at the remote that came with your TV. It freaking sucks from the perspective of trying to feel it. I mean, the only
when you get
the only remote
Harmony.
I've ever been able to do by feel is my Wii controller.
But look at
maybe
a Harmony.
Xbox 2.
Look at the Logitech Harmony. It's a fantastic device. Not the Harmony Link or the Harmony One. Like the Harmony One. It's a button device. You have to program it fine, and that does take time. But the idea that you can just like say I'm gonna watch a game now and hit it, and it's going to change your audio source. It's going to change your video source, and it's going to turn on that video source device with one button's push. I think that's really where things are. The idea that I'm going to keep – because even when I use my iPhone for my Apple TV, you know, integrated system, integrated thing, I click it. I get on there. It has to connect via the Wi-Fi to the Apple TV. Once it connects, then I get to move around some things. And then the minute I'm watching something for a while, I pick it up. And I slide to unlock, and it reopens, and the app is already there. And it has to reconnect to the Apple TV. And
really?
That, yeah, it does. That's the way it works. Because it can't leave. The only thing that's been left open indefinitely is the Boxy remote app. And I've seen it tick down the battery usage on my device as it stays open with a live Wi-Fi direct connection to the device at hand. So I feel like it's just not practical right now. It's sort of like the idea of using location based for everything on your phone right now. It's just not practical.
But they're giving you a Nexus 7 for free.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty nice device.
There's more. I mean, just listing off the features of this service is just insane. I mean, it's so attractive to just about anybody. They said that they've got two boxes for the service. One is the network box, which offers gigabit routing, Wi-Fi, 4 Ethernet ports, and simple network management. An identical-looking storage box will have 2 terabytes of storage that will act as the DVR for all the devices in the house. It'll work with Netflix and YouTube. It'll also act as a Wi-Fi access point. So Google says they're turning every TV into a Wi-Fi hotspot. The costs start with a $300 construction fee to get the fiber installed at your house.
Worth it.
Yeah, totally worth it.
Yeah, let's face it.
After that, there'll be two kinds of packages for Google Fiber. For $120 a month, the first package is the gigabit plus TV package with a terabyte of storage, internet, and a single lump of all channels in a single bundle. It includes major broadcast networks, hundreds of fiber channels, and on-demand movies and shows. Premium channels will be an additional monthly fee, and Google will waive that $300 construction fee. At $70 a month, a gigabit-only package will provide the internet and a terabyte of cloud storage on Google Drive. And then they've got a third package, which is just if you pay that $300 construction fee, it gives you average broadband speeds for free for like a year. This right now, as it is, even the $120 per month plus the $300 construction beats out my basic cable. right now. And that is the cable. Like, I'm paying for cable plus internet through my local service here, Charter.
And what are you paying? That sounds incredible, really ridiculous. What are you paying?
Yeah, it's not cheap. But I mean, okay. That's the cost that, because I don't really have a choice. It's either that or like DSL. You know, like you don't have a choice. If you want cable internet, because you're tied to the cable that you have, but this is a choice, mm-hmm. And I think it's a great idea. I think this is a real disruptive move on Google's part. This is the most exciting thing that to come out of Google. I think maybe since the search itself, since Google search itself.
I think Google Gmail was pretty big, but okay.
What do you guys think about this Google Fiber and with it also before tell me what you think, and then we'll get into, because there's some interesting points about how they want to roll this out to everybody, which we'll talk about.
It's clearly fantastic. I think the thing that it's interesting to me, the most interesting to me, is what the other cable companies think about it. I'm sure that many of them are sort of like, this isn't going to work. They're going to get bogged down by the same stuff we're bogged down by, yada, yada, yada. Now, Google is doing this because they can afford to, because getting more people connected without limits is the heart of getting more people to use their services, because it's the biggest website in the world. And, you know, maybe Facebook is the biggest website now. I don't know, but it's between the two of them. And I feel like this is a wonderfully powerful, you know, it's just a wonderful, way to look at things. I'm just really curious to see how the competition deals with it. If we're going to see, you know, regulators shoot up. If we're going to see what's happening with the phone space, where, you know, T-Mobile's trying to come out with $45 a month. Other guys are trying to come out with $45 a month because they know that the efficiencies are there. But the big guys are like, well, my margins are so high, I need to do it this way. Also, this is in I don't know how big the market is, the DMA is, for Kansas City and both Missouri and Kansas side. So that's a question that I have. I wonder what the real impact is going to be. Is it going to be a legitimate case study that the rest of the country can use? And are they there because it was easier to get the permits and everything to lay that pipe, as opposed to like a New York, which is like a nightmare for laying new cable, or like a San Francisco, a similar nightmare for laying new mm-hmm. cable. You know what I mean? So
I think like probably they wanted to start somewhere, you know, really relatively small and manageable, and with the idea, with the total intent of getting a lot of people excited about this. Because I mean, I was excited by this announcement, watching the live stream of the announcement. And I immediately wanted it in my neighborhood right away, which is interesting because, like, obviously Google does not have the manpower to roll this out on a broad scale immediately. So the interesting way that they're tackling this is they're making the user fight for it by socially engineering an interest in the service. You know, by expressing an interest online, and then getting your neighbors to all express an interest, and they're going with basically the fiberhoods, they're calling it, that express the largest interest in the service, which is really an interesting way to tackle the challenge of rolling this out without having the resources or the manpower to do it really on a broad scale.
Mm.
So I have a name for this story.
Yeah.
Occupy ISP. I feel like that's exactly what Google is aiming for this, right? Google's point is not
that's the name of this episode.
Into the ISP business. Google's point is to find a place anywhere USA, Kansas City. It's right in the center. Yeah. It's, okay, the Kaufman Foundation is based there, and they are an important nonprofit for entrepreneurship. But seriously, the point is, it's anywhere USA, and they're pointing out this is what's possible with the technology that we have today. Yeah. We can give you gigabit Ethernet. We can give you ridiculous stuff. Yes, we're probably going to run a little bit of a loss on it, but
at first,
their point is stir up the market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
just show what's possible, and basically sort of like throw off all this, like, you know, I mean, the whole ISP argument for the last several years has been like, oh, competition's too expensive. Mm-hmm. Upgrading to fiber is too expensive. We can't.
Well, the consumer became the enemy. They all work together, and they collude in some ways to show us that, you know, to leave us with this place where, well, let me just mark out the territory. This America, you know, we're gonna cut it up ourselves, like at the end of World War II. You guys are gonna get, you know, Comcast. You're gonna get these areas. Charter. You're gonna get these areas, and the rest of you are gonna get these other areas. And, you know, this big middle part and all these rural places, there's not enough money there, so we'll just leave them and abandon them, right? Like, that's kind of what happened. And I think Google is saying, well, you know, that doesn't need to happen. In fact, we can show you that this could happen in a better way. There's a better way.
Right. Why are the Comcasts and AT&Ts of the world complaining about how much it costs to serve up broadband when Google can deliver 100 times the traditional ISP's top speed for
the same? And the Google thing is that it's not, like, it's the quintessential, not a dumb pipe. That's what all these companies have become.
Right.
And that's what all these companies are being afraid of becoming. The dumb pipe that's going to deliver, you know, television content over the internet. You know, just like how they don't want to deliver phone, like, phone minutes over voice over IP. It's all possible, but they're like, it's too efficient for my model. So that's why you have, like, internet plus TV or internet. Or like wireless internet plus phone minutes and things like that. And Google's basically saying, screw all that. We'll just give you the internet and you can do anything on the internet, which is what Google's been saying the whole time. Even remember when Google Voice wasn't allowed on the iPhone and they just basically made a web page that did it. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of what they're about. So this is just an expression of them. And this is really, I think, if the promise is big, so I'm a little worried about that.
Yeah.
You know me and expectations, you know me and like, that kind of thing. The promise is big, but if they could pull this off, this is what Google does best. They should. They could even, like, you know, they do this. They've got their Plus service, which I just recently read is in many ways more favorable to Facebook to fans who have been to people that they've done surveys with, and is growing quite fast. And they've got their search, and they've got, you know, every other thing, the YouTube, all this other stuff. So they're making content on YouTube. They've got the search, which allows you to get to the rest of the web. They've got Plus, which allows you to share all the stuff, the wonderful stuff you'll find when you're watching the YouTube stuff or searching the web. And they're now giving you the ability to get to all that stuff physically. This is the package. This is the, you know, Chris, how many times have I said Google's trying not to be a one-trick pony? This is like the little, archstone, the keystone in the arch that can put all that together. You know, from a user lifestyle perspective,
I agree. I mean, this is a good thing. And as you, for long-time listeners, you know, like, I'm not the biggest Google fan, this is exactly what I'm proud of them for. You know, basically getting in there and stirring it up, and basically showing, hey, look, you know, it's not just Moore's law of processing that's driven forward computing. It's also been, I don't know what the law is, but I mean the increasing availability of bandwidth, the fact that we can get not just computers that can handle high def TV these days. I mean, if you believe Raspberry Pi stuff, I mean $35 computers that can handle HD. But the fact that we can handle internet connections that can handle HD is just as important, if not more so, because it handles so much of what is possible and what enables us what resources are available out there. I mean, like, the fact that, you know, as a startup of, you know, three or four people, we can, you know, access Amazon's EC2 instances and instantly have what's essentially a supercomputer available to us is huge news in the startup world.
It fuels the app world.
Yeah. Yeah. It fuels everything. It fuels the mobile world. It fuels the netbook world. It fuels the desktop world. It fuels Apple TV. And the fact that Apple TV doesn't have to do 90% of the work because it's been done on Apple servers is a huge direction what makes Apple TV possible.
I think that what the potential that this has for cable providers, I'm sorry, for internet providers is huge, but I think even more so, I think that the cable providers, the cable TV providers, really do have to be afraid about this because, I mean, this is completely disruptive, and they could, in one fell swoop, just send, you know, the big companies like Comcast and Charter on the run.
They're gonna get a lot of resistance. There's gonna be some sort of government inquiry attached to this crap. This isn't crap, but there's gonna be some government inquiry crap attached to this, because these people, they have a lot of people that they employ.
Right.
And
there's a lot of money involved.
They have a lot of people that they employ, and we all know that what's going to happen is that the guys who run the company aren't going to take a pay cut. They're just going to lay off people. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like they're gonna say, oh, you know, like the times are tougher. We're going to have to lay you guys off because we're not making the margins we need to make.
Yeah.
And that's going to trickle down. Like when Verizon had their issue, the CEO took home $29 million and he got rid of, like, you know, hundreds and hundreds of employees. As a bonus, he took home $29 million. So what we're going to see is, if there is true disruption,
mm-hmm.
there's going to be some sort of inquiry, some sort of, like, basically, I think there's going to be a means for, like, the lobby, the cable internet lobby, and a whole bunch of others to come through and say, look, this is tampering with, you know, the jobs that we have. This is tampering with the way this is in its business. It's just too efficient. We're not ready for it. And also the crap's going to show through. So this is really interesting on that level. I also think it's interesting because the content holders are probably scared as well, because people who download content, like, you know, whether it's Torrent or Usenet or whatever, they're going to quickly be able to get the content in a way that's unprecedented. It's one thing to have 30 megabits down or 100 megabits down. Another thing is just 100 megabits down. So, you know, you can download stuff at like 3 megabits, 8 megabits at a time per second. So you can get like a full HD movie in like 10 minutes. That's one thing. But to be able to stream a full HD movie off of like a Usenet server, that's something wholly different. You know what I mean? Like, to be able to get that bandwidth in real time without any restrictions, without any scrutiny, without any, like, you know, with no real monitor of what's going on. And Google, you know, is currently fighting to make sure that you can, like, you know, some people want to censor Google's ability to search, to allow users to search for the word torrent.
Yeah.
Google's currently fighting that. So Google is in many ways the champion of the web. Whereas you look at Apple, and there are many ways, you know, the people who make devices that use the internet, not the web, but the internet, to deliver content from partners, you know, at the significant margin. Where Google's, they're just kind of saying, I really care less about that, and I really care more about what's possible, and, like, you know, getting everybody on, because once they're on, they're with me. So it's a fundamentally different layout. It's very, like you said, it's very disruptive. And I really wonder what sort of challenges they're going to face. But I do stand behind this initiative more than, let's say, Google Glasses.
Right.
Nice. Good. Right. Yeah, I agree. Because, I mean, Google Glasses is cool, but then it, like, oh, I saw a science fiction show where they had that once.
Yeah. For me,
I wouldn't buy it. I'm glad other people can buy it. You know, like, this is something like, it's a definite need right now. And the market needs stirring up. I mean, it's funny that the U.S. is in this weird place where we essentially regulate physical bandwidth.
Yeah.
Sorry, bumped my thing. Physical bandwidth separate from air bandwidth. I mean, I sort of realized this from my travels abroad, that most of the countries regulate cable bandwidth not too dissimilarly from over-the-air bandwidth. There's a limited amount of bandwidth. There's an existing infrastructure of bandwidth that's delivered. And just because you own the pipe doesn't mean you own the content that's delivered over the pipe. And that competition drives, you know, a competitive, healthy atmosphere. Whereas, I mean, let's face it, there is no competition in high bandwidth content in the US. I mean, whether it's TV or cable or DSL or fiber or TV or internet, basically you have one choice, and by and large, across the country, you have two choices. You either have Comcast or Verizon. And if you're lucky, you might have somebody else that's essentially a replacement monopoly for one of those two. But it's not competition. And so there's been, you know, basically no effort. I mean, Verizon sort of started their Fios thing in a few markets and basically gave it up. And until somebody comes along and actually stirs it up, or the regulatory system, you know, forces them to actually allow for competition.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even blame them in that case. I mean, goodness, if you're a company and you have a natural monopoly and the government's not going to, you know, is basically going to protect your monopoly, then I wouldn't be complaining if I was Comcast about the situation.
Right.
But as a consumer, we should be complaining. Like, it's not natural for Comcast to own our entire access to the internet. We're like one of the few countries in which that's the case. So we should fight it. We should complain about it. I mean, this is the same thing we're seeing with the NBC Olympics. I mean, 10 years ago, my family watched the Olympics entirely over the air TV. Now, even watching it over the air is not possible, let alone watching it on
the... You can watch just a bit of it over the air. I mean, they say, yeah, streaming's available, but it's only available if you have all these caveats. The fact is, there is a way now to get access to the BBC streaming version of the what's it called, the Olympics, that doesn't involve jumping through the hoops that I had to jump through just to get it, you know, legally to work on my system. And well, it's not an illegal way to do it.
It's not. I mean, the thing that amazes me is, like, you know, I hang around on hacker programmer forums, and a number of them have posted various ways of getting, you know, the Olympics streaming for pay. I mean, this is not a for free way to get the Olympics through some, you know, janky service. People are paying $20, $30, $40, you know, per month for hosting, for various, you know, VPN rerouting services to get stuff through the BBC. I mean, people are willing to pay substantial amounts of money for this, and yet for whatever stupid licensing agreements that have come up in the last 10 years, cable is king, I guess. And so, you know, the ability to pay is not as important as the ability for the cable companies to, you know, get the ability to own this content.
You ever feel like the... This is going to sound silly, but you ever feel like we're, like, kind of experiencing that whole, like, 1999 original Matrix film system of control, and we're always trying to break out of it with these little hacks that get us into, like, a VPN, or they get us, you know, get us the access to the content over the phone line, or, you know, this whole thing with Google and how they're trying to, like, break us out of these ideas, you know what I mean?
You know,
I feel like there's kind of, like, a matrixy feeling to all this.
Like, regarding the Google thing, it feels to me, this feels analogous to when digital media became, like, the primary media for cameras, you know, and then you had all these old legacy film companies that manufactured physical film. All of a sudden, it's like you could hear the death knell tolling, and you knew that these guys were only going to be around for another few years and that'd be it. And that, to me, feels like what's going on here with the
I don't know if we can go that far. I have a feeling there's a whole bunch of fight left in the cable companies, than you'll see in, like, traditional.
I think there will be a lot of fighting, but I think it's going to end up like the film companies, or like the record labels, with the you know, holding out for physical distribution of music. I think it's going to be the same thing, and I think only somebody on the level of Google. This is good, really going to skyrocket Google into a different strata than where it is right now. You know, on the level of Google is on the level of an Apple, or I think Google, this could actually take Google to the level of an Apple, which is Apple is like the, you know, the most successful and
company ever.
Yeah, most money making technology company ever.
No, just the most money making company ever.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Google definitely has a has the ability to do something wonderful here. We'll see how it goes. I want to wait
until
we see what happens. And I know that's not what everyone wants to hear. Obviously, right. Like, hey, make a choice, whatever. But I really think that we have to wait and see how this pans out.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's going to take a while because the whole way they're rolling it out where people have to kind of fight for it. And I think that's just a matter of meeting the limitations of their manpower to roll out the fiber. But it will happen eventually. All right, so let's take a little break here and listen to a little bit more music. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the 2012 London Olympics and all of the morass of problems involved on both the technical end and in social media and in online journalism. And with that, so take a listen to this. And come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down Live on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Christopher Bernard. And let's talk about the Olympics. 2012 London Olympics. Probably the most connected, most technologically advanced Olympics ever. I'm going to throw some numbers out from you. This is from an article at datacenterknowledge.com, and it's basically about the infrastructure powering the Olympics. They said the Olympics network will span 30,000 connections across 94 locations. It's provided by Cisco Systems, and it includes 2,200 switches, 1,800 wireless access points, 7,000 cable TV sockets, 16,500 telephones, 6,500 active network ports, over 90 British Telecom people will work in 12-hour shifts with changeovers to manage the data center hubs. The Olympics will be streamed by like never before. Nearly 20% of UK residents say they expect to stream some of the coverage on their PC, laptops, and tablets, and that's not even counting the people in America. BBC predicts that its live footage will generate an excess of 1 terabit per second of traffic at peak times, the equivalent of 1,500 people downloading a feature-length DVD quality movie every minute. Plus, mobile networks will be under extraordinary pressure. Olympic venues such as the BT Wi-Fi network at the core Olympic Park site is designed to handle 100,000 users. So it's an awesome undertaking for this. And I have to say, you know, you were, I can't remember, was it Dwayne? You were talking about the NBC app on the Olympic app on your iPad before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have to say that I've had a lot of good experience with that. You say you hated it because it was real choppy and everything.
It was choppy. It kept on like screwing up when it came to like allowing me to communicate with the Comcast network. Yeah. Like it would say, I click on Comcast. Oh, okay. So why don't you subscribe to Comcast now? No, I'm already subscribed. Oh, okay. I don't really know what that means. Why don't you call up Comcast now? So it was just kind of like, oh, God, like, be smoother. Present me with a login. Pass it through to the Comcast server. You know, verify the credentials. Come back and be like, oh, you're good.
I've had, like, the complete opposite experience. Like, you know how when you're watching a commercial about some sort of, you know, cell phone device or something, and they're showing on that device access to live TV, and underneath the disclaimer says, you know, images are simulated, and it because it looks so rock solid, clear and sharp and smooth, and you're going, of course they're simulated because, you know, nothing on any real world device actually looks like that. I have to say that with this app, I've experienced that very same quality, like actual smooth and sharp viewing. So I don't know if it's my ISP or what, but like I've had no complaints about their app. I mean, I think other than like the huge complaint that everybody is having has had is that, you know, while NBC has made allowances to show every single Olympic event, I thought that it was kind of bogus for them that the only event that you couldn't stream online live was the opening ceremony, which they say was that was a decision. I can't remember what their decision was, but
the decision
was
to make some money.
That's clearly
what
it is.
Everyone watching at the same time, yeah. Means that ad buy goes up exponentially.
Exactly, it's clearly to get the butts in the seats in front of the TV and make people watch on TV, which I thought was kind of bogus. I mean, first of all, because it disrupted the way that I usually that I'm used to watching things nowadays, which is like as when I want to watch them and not necessarily live.
Yeah, there's a fundamental change. Like I am interested in watching TV shows. Yeah. I am not interested in watching the TV.
Right.
And that's where the real disruption comes in, because they want you. I mean, it's in their best interest. Like how Google's doing this right now. Google wants you to be on the web and kind of meander and look for stuff and find stuff and all those things, right?
Yeah.
Whereas the efficiencies I've built into my life are such that I'm there to like I want to see a show. I want to see Mad Men. I want to see whatever. I want to get in there. I want to take a look at what I want to look at, and I want to get out. I don't want to flip through channels. And that's a problem because that's the traditional way of them making that money, by you flipping through channels, by you moving, by you like seeing a commercial here and there while you're getting caught in something that seems like random, but whatever. It's the unsung that like that way of discovering new television and new things to watch and new things to keep you there. That whole channel surfing is the unsung hero of the television traditional media industry.
Yeah.
So the idea is that you don't do that anymore, and that's
right.
I'm not going to say it scares them, but it disrupts the way that they currently do their business. And the fact is, you simply don't get. I mean, the thing is, if you have an embedded advertisement sitting on your in your mobile application, like you know Hulu style advertisement or whatever, everyone's watching that ad. But the thing is, the advertisers are only paying the big bucks for the traditional TV layout. They're used to that, and so. You know, there's issues there. But the fact is, when you show that pre-roll advertisement, when you show all that other stuff, you're actually getting a better idea of what you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
You get better metrics, better stats. But what you don't get is the idea that you might have a household looking at your ad.
Right.
So that's like, you know, 8 eyeballs with 4 people as opposed to just 2 eyeballs looking at an iPad.
Right.
And I think that's where things get a little annoying.
I found NBC's statement. Now listen to this and tell me how ridiculous this sounds. NBC defended the decision to tape delay the opening ceremonies, and they said in an emailed statement that the ceremonies are complex entertainment spectacles that do not translate well online because they require context, which our award-winning production team will provide for the large primetime audiences that gather together to watch them.
You mean the people are going to comment over the whole time and like
not
show the full thing that we've read about online.
This is the thing. Like when I went to see The Dark Knight Rises last weekend, it started showing like this. The trailer had this clip of a movie with like, you know, fantastic things like, you know, spaceships and laser guns and everything. And the screen got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until it was like a computer screen with some tinny speakers that says, "Nothing this awesome should be reduced to this." Now they're telling this to people who paid for the movie, who are sitting and paying for the movie. And I feel like that's kind of the argument they're making. Like, this is a big spectacle, so you have to watch it at home with everybody. You can't watch it on your own on a tablet because it's really just not going to pull it off. And that was a little...
Yeah, I'm talking about, like, you know, Matt Lauer and Meredith Vieira making their inane comments. You know what I'm talking about.
Way to sock it to Matt Lauer and Meredith Vieira.
I mean, if you saw NBC's broadcast of the opening ceremony, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
I gotta say, I didn't mind their coverage. I had to go find the YouTube of the Queen because I missed that part. I didn't mind their coverage too much, but I also, I guess I was so much more awed by the actual ceremony, I was just focusing on comparing it to the Chinese one 4 years earlier that I wasn't really thinking about the inane nature of their comments.
Not to mention whatever was excised out of the broadcast for U.S. viewers.
That's true.
Like there was that whole number that was a tribute to victims of terrorism from 7/7, but I think it was fitting for victims of terrorism in any context, and I don't know why that's
what I heard most. I mean, so I haven't seen either one, but all the commentaries I read in it was saying basically this is awesome because it's fundamentally a sort of tribute to the general tragedy of terrorism.
Right.
The Western world is at war with terrorism. And I know it's a weird thing to say, and I know it's George Bush's term and everything, but it's true. We're constantly like fighting terrorist acts. And I'm not talking about Arab terrorism, and I'm not talking about Muslim terrorism. I'm talking about the stuff that happened in my state a couple days ago.
Exactly.
People afraid to go to movies now because of what could happen. You know, whether it's completely political or whether whatever, people are afraid of that. And I think that knowing that across the Western world, at least, and you know, terrorism does happen in the Middle East, in the Far East, but you know, that's solidarity about innocent people being taken away from the world while doing very ordinary things. I think that was something it's just a strange thing that America's broadcast team thought that was inappropriate for us.
Right.
You know, it's weird.
I was a little insulted, to be honest.
Honestly, yeah, insulted is the best term for it because, like, we're America. Gee, nothing like that has ever happened in the U.S. Like, it's not like we have any way that we can relate to that, you know. Like, I don't know, particularly as, like, I grew up in North Jersey. Like I don't know, I'm almost offended by that. Like, that they would think that somehow that's something that we couldn't handle.
Well, that's the problem. It's
after
subtle...
having lived through it, like,
yeah.
Gee, it freaking happened. Like, and let's not face it, in a way that's worse than the UK. Like, that's something that we should... I don't know what the term is. But
when the UK is doing it, when the UK, the people who are like, keep calm and carry on and move forward and don't look back to the past and, like, you know, stiff upper lip and all that stuff, when they're doing a tribute like that,
yeah,
and a company that's as emotional and raw as ours is trying to exclude that, it goes to show how the media looks at you know, the sophistication of the audience. The UK audience, you know, in many ways is sophisticated. Their education system is better. And this is that whole, like, you'll hear about it when it comes, you've heard this term when it comes to, like, schools and minorities and stuff. But this is the subtle disrespect of low expectations. Like, give us high, put high expectations on top of us. Make us, force us to deal with issues. And we will deal with them and get better
at it. Don't patronize us. Don't downplay our intelligence. You know, let us rise to the level of what we're able to handle.
Yeah, and like you also wonder, like the TV guys, they're not good at curating the information anymore, perhaps.
Right.
We talk about curation on the web a lot. That's what like Reddit is good for. Yeah. That's what like Dig was and will be good for again, things like that. It's just that you look at this kind of stuff and you're kind of like, curation can be dangerous too. Over curation, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what I see here, what I feel here, and I'm worried about it.
NBC was at the center of another controversy this week when it persuaded Twitter to suspend an independent journalism. And by independent, I don't mean the journalist is independent. He works for the newspaper, The Independent, the UK newspaper, who criticized the coverage of the Olympics. Guy Adams, the Independent's Los Angeles correspondent, was removed from the social networking site on the day that he wrote a news story detailing widespread public complaints about the network's coverage of the London Games. According to Twitter, he was suspended for a message posted during the opening ceremony when NBC prevented viewers of America from watching that coverage that we talk about. He wrote a tweet saying, "The man responsible for NBC pretending the Olympics haven't started yet is Gary Zenkel. Tell him what you think." And then he put the work email address of Mr. Zenkel in his tweet. And Twitter claimed that the tweet breached its guidelines for posting an individual's private information, such as a private email address, to which he responded, "I didn't publish a private email address, just a corporate email address." And he said, "Either way, it's quite worrying that NBC, whose parent company is an Olympic sponsor, is apparently trying, in this case succeeding, in shutting down the Twitter accounts of journalists who are critical of their Olympic coverage." Did you guys check out any of this controversy?
That is weird.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with that one. I honestly, I'm having a little trouble keeping track of all the controversies associated with the Olympics this year.
Twitter actually apologized. They said the team working closely with NBC around our Olympics partnership did proactively identify a tweet that it was in violation of the Twitter rules. They said,
"Oh, I'm sorry, I remember this one. Yeah, this was the one where there was like a miscommunication between the teams. Like one team identified this as a possible violation, the other one didn't realize that another Twitter team had identified it."
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a better realization that like, I don't know. This is one of those situations where I feel like I'm on all sides. Like, on the one hand, like with Twitter, I realize that, you know, you got to be careful about people using your service to harass people.
Mm-hmm,
and I feel like that's just as important if they're nobodies as if they're somebodies. Like, as much as I might be with my political stance, like just, you know, like, I don't know, like you can't just because it's a
big shot, something. You can't treat them like, you know, like, you know, but like any differently than the average person because they deserve their privacy too. They deserve their rights as well.
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of fundamentally my political stance. It's like, if you're a nobody, your rights matter. If you're a somebody, your rights still matter.
but I don't want to condone necessarily harassment, but I think there was a difference between like he was calling for people to complain about this man in a professional sense by posting his work email. He wasn't necessarily attacking him personally. And I think that maybe Twitter misunderstood that. And they actually were tipped off by NBC. Like, NBC tipped Twitter off and said, "Hey, this guy is, you know, breaking your rules," which, you know, clearly it was a work email, so it wasn't necessarily a violation of those rules. I mean, it's one thing to get to use a bully pulpit to harass a individual on a personal level, and it's another one to use that same bully pulpit to harass an employee for on, you know, in doing their their job, essentially, especially if they're their job is to provide a public service. I don't know. Does that make any sense?
Yep.
Yeah, that's actually a good
a
point.
Bit. I mean, it's the argument is only this: the man acted in a professional context to suppress information. Twitter is all about not suppressing information.
Right.
Community. Someone took his professional contact information, and they put it out there to say, "Hey, this guy is the guy to talk to about this issue." And NBC equivocated and said, "This is someone's email address." And Twitter was like, "Oh no, email address." Whoever was like making that choice, and that's what ends up like, you know, getting this situation in trouble. So, I think Andy has a point. I think it doesn't defy Chris's point. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm, like Chris's point is still like valid. It's just that NBC was able to get one over on Twitter on this,
right?
You know,
and ultimately, I mean, Twitter, to their credit, they corrected it. They said, "We don't proactively report or remove content on behalf of other users, no matter who they are. This behavior is not acceptable and undermines the trust our users have in us. We should not and cannot be in the business of proactively monitoring and flagging content, no matter who the user is, whether a business partner, celebrity, or friend." So, I mean, props to them for correcting this and restoring the journalist's Twitter account back. So there you go. Any other complaints or interesting points about the technical or social media aspects of the Olympics before we wrap up our show?
The badminton controversy, man.
What?
Basically, there's a tourney, and there are multiple like little teams in it. Uh-huh. And the Americans were like, "It's a tourney. We want to win. Therefore, we're going to throw this game and throw that game to make sure the standing for this other team is good." It's like cycling, right? In cycling, there's a guy in the team.
Yeah.
There are people who aren't supposed to win. They're just supposed to block and tackle, like football, like any other American sport. And so this tactic was used, and then they were like, "Yo, you're disqualified because you can't like throw a game in the Olympics. It's the Olympics."
Right.
It's not in the rules anywhere,
right.
But it's the Olympics. But it's not in the rules anywhere. But it's the Olympics.
Right.
So, we make the rules.
It's against the spirit of the Olympics, if not the letter of the Olympics. Mm-hmm. The most exciting thing that I saw, just completely off the tech topic, but still on the Olympic topic, was there was a match between a German and a Korean épée fencer. And it was tied up and it came down to literally the last second, which, you know, every time you you fence and you there's a certain point where you're fencing and you have to stop the clock and restart the clock. Well, they restarted the clock at the last second, but they restarted it several times in a row for a duration that was longer than an actual second.
Yeah, and that was whack. I saw that.
And in the
at first, from the clip, I couldn't tell.
She
what the
like
was
hung
going
out
on
the thing for like 40 minutes.
Yeah, well, that was the deal. Is that at the very
you can't get off of the podium
at the very last.
If you get off the piste, you lose your right to challenge. So she had to wait.
Which
there. She was quite embarrassed.
Stupid. Like, the podium is clearly what defines your ability to
argue a rational, like make a rational argument.
It's like if our justice system was based on like, if you leave the crime, then you then you agree with what the cops.
It's basically a filibuster, a sports filibuster, is what it was.
I was proud of her for staying on.
Me too.
Whatever the rules say, like just for the fact that she stayed on, like I almost feel like she deserves a medal just
for her perseverance. And just the range of emotions that were going on that poor girl's face.
And the apathy
whole
from the rest of the freaking crowd. That was just so weird. The crowd was like, "Oh, that's interesting. She lost. Bye." And it was like, "Oh, come on, guys.
This is a gold medal we're talking about." Yeah.
It's a medal. I mean, these people, like, we always forget that these people have worked their whole lives to get here. Their entire lives to get here. So, I don't know. I feel like have some respect.
Yeah.
There's a reason why this series of games is way more important than the
the hundreds of championship titles that happen throughout the year, like the world champion of this and the world champion of that. You'll see that on the Wikipedia when you look up an athlete. And you're like, oh, that's interesting. They won gold in that, but it's not the Olympics.
Right. Anything else before we wrap it up?
No, I think we're good.
All right. Well, let me start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find you online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
Check me out on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. That's D-W-A-Y-N-E-D, gplus.to/DwayneD. And also check me out on intermundomedia.com, where we have a baby blog that we're throwing out there.
Oh.
And I'll be
not literally a blog about babies.
No, no, no. It's just it's a nascent blog. It's a new blog regarding what we do and how we do it and what our thoughts are. So I'll be writing a bit about social media and what, like, kind of the rules are surrounding advertising. I'll be writing about some other things. And so, you know, feel free to check it out and let me know what you think.
All right. Chris, how about yourself? Where can we find you online when you're not here on the show?
You can find me at Twitter at Chris Brunor, CHRESBURNOR. And I've been blogging a little bit more at chrisbrunor.com. And I co-curate the best startup articles and events with Chris McCann on Startup Digest, where you can get weekly emails on startup articles and events. Basically, whatever city you are. We're in, like, 100 cities worldwide now, so you probably nice. Are there.
All right. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com, gplus.to/MrBabyMan, my Google Plus link where all of my social links are, Facebook.com, MrBabyMan, Twitter.com, MrBabyMan. You can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to Geeks of Doom, and we're in the upper right-hand corner there on the sidebar. Our show is now on Stitcher, so you can listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and other devices. Go to your favorite app store, whether it be an Android or iPhone or whatever, and go and look at search for Stitcher.com. Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. Sign up at jade.mp/subus to get SMS alerts when The Drill Down goes live. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about, we'd love to hear from you. You know, let us know what your opinion is. Send that idea, your story, to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on our on thedrilldown.com. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that's our wonderful Drill Down audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.